Our next speaker is Sharon Keeling, a barrister on Green's List, who is uniquely placed to talk about the subject she's going to speak on today. Sharon's got a medical background, initially training as a nurse and then undertaking medical studies, specifically training in paediatrics and clinical genetics. She had an extremely successful career as a doctor, winning the A.H. Ward Prize as the best intern at Royal Melbourne, an NHMRC scholar while undertaking doctoral studies at the Ludwig Institute for Cancer Research in Melbourne, and did Doctor of Philosophy in Molecular Neurogenetics. She was a member of the, a fellow of the Royal Australasian College of Physicians, and continues to lecture in deafness and genetics at the School of Audiology at University of Melbourne. She came to the bar not because the gene pool here is so confused, but and since coming to the bar, she has obviously specialised in medical negligence. I've had the privilege of working with her on many occasions, and her knowledge of medicine is as good as anybody's at the bar, I'm sure, and better than many medical practitioners. She's published a number of learned articles in medico-legal areas and speaks widely on the topic, both to lawyers and to doctors. Her subject today, when is a hospital responsible for the care of a privately treating doctor, is a fascinating one, and when plaintiff's lawyers are dealt, have a patient come to them who's been injured in a hospital and it's a private hospital, it's always a difficult choice to identify the proper parties to join. When it's a public hospital, it's not so difficult, but often in a public hospital situation, individual doctors will be named. But where it's a private hospital and a patient's admitted as a private patient, and perhaps something goes wrong so that the patient has no say in who is treating that patient, the questions become blurred. No doubt at the end of this talk, they'll be as crystal clear. Could you welcome Sharon Keeling?
Thank you, David, and good morning. A doctor is always liable for his or her conduct. So if a doctor performs negligently, then they will be liable, so they can be named and bear the responsibility. At issue is, if a doctor is privately treating a patient, whether in a public or a private setting, is the hospital liable? Conventional legal wisdom is that if it's a private hospital, the doctor's subcontracting to the hospital and therefore the hospital is not liable because the doctor's not an employee. Conventional wisdom says if it's a public hospital, then because the doctors are employees, the hospital is liable, and often the hospital only is named. But there are changes occurring in both private and public hospital settings regarding who's treated publicly or under an employment relationship and who's treated privately. And the consequences of that are, I think, particularly interesting. So a hospital is not a mere custodial institution designed to provide a place where medical personnel could meet and treat their people who are lodged there. It's not like a hotel where the doctors just drop in. That is, the hospital has obligations of its own. And this is a photograph of the Albrighton, the Royal Prince Alfred Hospital. I looked for the Albrighton Hospital for a while and couldn't find it. So this is the Royal Prince Alfred Hospital in the 19th century. That's in Sydney, of course. So there's really two circumstances where a hospital, and I want you for the moment to put aside the question of whether it's a private or a public hospital, because the principles apply equally across the board. Two times when a hospital will be held to be liable for the conduct of a treating doctor. The first is when the relationship between the hospital and the doctor is deemed or found by the court to be an employment relationship. And I'll talk about the factors that the court will take into account when considering, is this more an employment relationship or is this a subcontracting relationship? The second case is where, and this is the area which is changing or has changed particularly over the last decade, is where the hospital actually undertakes to the patient to provide the medical care. So, the important thing, as you know, is that an employer is vicariously liable for the conduct of an employee, including a doctor. This was considered by the High Court in Stevens and Brodribb and also in Hollis and Varbu. And those principles, which weren't hospital settings, apply equally well to the hospital-doctor relationship. So, whether the worker is an employee is a question of fact, and therefore it's a jury question. That is, it's open for discussion and open to be held or to be found. It's not something that a hospital or a doctor or a plaintiff can come along and say definitively, this is the relationship. It's a matter for the tribunal to be deciding. So, the central question is the doctor acting on her own behalf or on behalf of the hospital? Another way of putting that is, in treating patients at the hospital, is the doctor engaged in his own business or in the business of the hospital? And this is a picture of the Wallsend Hospital in 1870 when it was first built. Couldn't find the Ellis Hospital again. That joke's probably getting a bit old. That was the question that was posed. Whose business is the doctor in? So there are a series of factors that the court will look at and take into consideration when deciding, is this an employment relationship, is this a subcontracting relationship? Obviously the terms of any written contract will be highly relevant, but a court will find that it's an employment relationship notwithstanding that the contract says this is a subcontracting relationship. That is, if it walks like a duck, quacks like a duck, it's a duck, no matter if you point to it and say that's actually a chicken. Control of the hospital over the conduct of the doctor. I have never seen a situation where the hospital can dictate to a doctor how she's to treat her patients. However, there are factors that will be looked at, and it's not about what actual control is exercised, it's about the right to control the doctor. So, for example, often in a private hospital, a patient will come in having seen the doctor in his private rooms, and the doctor will have filled out the consent form and had the patient sign that on hospital stationery. So, and that would be pretty much a usual practice, and that will be a factor that may be considered. That is, here the hospital is telling the doctor, it may be interpreted, and it's open for debate, how to, which consent forms to use, and that would be a factor that would tend towards a decision of employment. The right to have a particular person to do the work. If you're subcontracting, there at least may be an opportunity to substitute someone else. The doctor may say, look, I'm off to overseas for a couple of weeks and Dr. Bloggs is going to substitute for me. If it's an employment relationship, you can't do that. If the hospital says you can't substitute anyone else under any circumstances, and that may be for credentialing reasons, which I'll come to, it may be that that's another factor pushing the relationship towards an employment relationship. The right to suspend or dismiss the person engaged directly, that is, the hospital can say, we're going to sack you for whatever reason, we're not going to have your visitation rights are going to be, your visiting rights are going to be removed. If that has to be done through a company or through a series of not direct processes, then it's more likely to be subcontracting. However, if it can be done directly and fairly summarily, then that's more likely to push the relationship towards being an employment relationship. This next factor is really quite important. That is, the right to dictate the place of work, the hours of work, are very important. So, for example, let's say a surgeon has a permanent operating session Tuesday mornings, and the hospital says to the surgeon, you can't have Tuesday mornings anymore, you're going to operate on Friday afternoons. If the hospital is able to do that, then the court will think that's tending towards being an employment relationship. Who provides the equipment? Usually hospitals provide the equipment, again, tending towards a employment relationship. Sometimes surgeons will have their own favourite pair of scissors or retractor or whatever, but if the hospital's providing all the equipment, again, tends towards an employment relationship. Whose goodwill is created by the doctor's work? Is it the hospital's or is it the doctor's? If you've got a hospital where the doctor's names, as soon as you walk into the foyer, there's a lovely big list of all the doctors, rather than just for, say, directory purposes, then it may be that the doctor's goodwill is being improved by the doctor's work at the hospital as well as the hospital's. If the doctor's names are prominently displayed, it may be that that's an employment relationship. And does the doctor work at only one hospital? David and I were discussing this just before this talk. Many of you will know that if a barrister works predominantly for one firm or has briefs predominantly from one firm, then she might get into trouble with the Australian Taxation Commissioner, who may say, in fact, that's an employment relationship and we'd like some pay-as-you-go tax deducted from your fees. Horror. However, does the corollary exist? That is, if a doctor's working predominantly in one hospital, does that make them an employee? I think the answer has to be that it makes it more likely that the doctor will be found to be an employee if he's working just at one hospital. The next factor is, does the hospital undertake any administrative work for the doctor? And a good example of this is that this hospital, which is the Royal Melbourne Hospital, the photograph on the left is from 1944 when the hospital opened. Those of you who may have an interest in hospital history will know that the American Army occupied the hospital for the first few years of its existence. And of course, the pointer, but you can see that on the left there is what used to be the Charles Conybeare Nursing Home, but is now, of course, the new Royal Women's Hospital. So at the Royal Melbourne Hospital, and this is all freely available public information, on their website is an offer by the hospital to undertake the billing for the doctors. It's very helpful and thoughtful of the hospital, but so you can use their medical billing service. For doctors, offers a comprehensive medical billing facility that is flexible, confidential and professional. This billing service can only be for patients who are being treated privately. Public patients don't pay. Medicare pays and there's no bills to be paid or issued to patients at all. At the Royal Melbourne, if you're a private patient, the hospital will undertake the billing for you. Great service for the doctors, I'm sure, but pushes the relationship from subcontracting towards the employment end. Does the hospital require the doctor to report to it any adverse events, particularly if there's been a complaint to the Office of the Health Services Commissioner? Has there been a complaint to the Medical Board of Australia, APRA? Or worse, has there been a writ issued in the County Court or the Supreme Court? Or indeed, is there an inquest to be held in the Coroner's Court of Victoria, where the doctor's conduct will be examined? One approach to this is that this is the hospital performing proper credentialing. That is, the hospital wants to know if the doctor's had an adverse event, or there's been an alleged adverse event, so that the hospital can know what's happening or what may be alleged against doctors who are working at that hospital. But another view says, if the doctor has to report to the hospital any adverse event, that's more behaviour that pushes the relationship towards the employment end. So the central issue is the doctor acting on her behalf or on the hospital's behalf? So when may a doctor be found to be an employee of a hospital, whether it's public or private, particularly in the setting where they're treating private patients in a public hospital? If the hospital's entered into an agreement for a particular doctor to treat the patients, and that would be the usual case, that will push the relationship towards an employment relationship. If the hospital requires a surgeon, for example, to use a particular anaesthetist, that sort of control over the work or the associated work of the surgeon will be looked at as pushing the relationship towards an employment relationship. If the hospital collects fees for the doctor, if the doctor works only at one hospital, if the hospital requires the doctor to comply with treatment protocols, this is an interesting question. Many hospitals now have patient treatment guidelines, whatever they're called, on their website or at least freely available internally. And if the hospital requires a doctor to, in fact, follow those protocols, then that, again, pushes the relationship in an employment direction. If any grievances are required to be reported, if the hospital determines when the doctor can operate, if the doctor can be suspended, and if the names of the doctors are not prominently displayed. So that's looking at the first question. The court will ask, is this an employment relationship? If it's an employment relationship, notwithstanding a contract or subcontracting arrangement, then the hospital will be vicariously liable for the conduct of the doctor. The second set of circumstances where a hospital may be held to be liable for the treatment by a privately treating doctor is when, in fact, the hospital undertakes to provide medical care to the patient, and that's becoming more common. Hospitals, of course, owe a duty of care to patients, and that was held in Condon State Transport Authority, where it said that the liability of a hospital arises out of its undertaking an obligation to treat its patient, an obligation that carries with it a duty of reasonable care in treatment, so that the hospital is liable, and that's really across the board. I've put a little asterisk there that this case was considering a public hospital that had undertaken to provide the medical care. So this applies only where the hospital's applied, has undertaken to provide the medical care. So Ellis and Wallsend goes further, which says a hospital is bound to ensure that reasonable care is used in providing the treatment which it undertakes to carry out, but that duty does not extend to treatment which is performed by a doctor pursuant to a direct engagement with the patient and not on behalf of the hospital. So the key issue here is it's a question of what medical services the hospital has undertaken to provide. A hospital will owe to a patient a non-delegable duty of care if it undertakes to provide medical care to that patient. So what sort of scenarios in both public and privately treated patients in a public hospital and in a private hospital apply? So did the doctor choose the hospital for the patient, or did the hospital choose the doctor? And this is the John James Hospital, because that is the question that was posed in the John James Memorial Hospital and Keys. It's a very modern looking hospital. So this again is the Royal Prince Alfred Hospital. You'll notice it's changed a little bit since the 19th century. It's now been completely updated in Sydney. So if a hospital presents, if a patient presents to the hospital that undertakes to provide all the services, then the hospital owes the non-delegable duty of care. And that scenario is the usual one. Patient presents to the emergency department in a public hospital, admitted as a public patient, straightforward situation. And that was found in, again, Albright and Royal Prince Alfred, which was cited with approval by the High Court. Over the last decade or two, there's been an increase in the number of private hospitals who provide emergency department services to the public. That is, you can pop along to the Epworth Hospital in Richmond. They've got a lovely emergency department, as does Cabrini, for example. More and more hospitals are private hospitals are providing emergency department facilities. This is a photograph of the Cabrini Hospital in Wattle Tree Road in Malvern. The only time that a private hospital will not be responsible for the emergency department treatment of a patient will be if the doctor has sent the patient along, rung the emergency department and said, my patient Bloggs is coming in, I'll see them and they'll be admitted through me, or there's been prior arrangement with a doctor with admitting rights. So when is it likely that the hospital chooses the doctor for the patient? The obvious one is where they attend an emergency department. You go in, you get your number, you get called in, you see Dr. X, whoever that is, whoever is on duty in the emergency department. It's incontrovertible that that doctor has been chosen for the patient by the hospital. But looking beyond the emergency department, let's say a patient's admitted. Come along to the hospital with your gallbladder pain or need your appendix out, and you get admitted. The hospital says to you, the emergency department doctor says to you, Miss X is on this weekend, and so we'll get her to come and see you, being the surgeon. If only one name is given, then the hospital is clearly choosing the doctor for the patient. Most private hospitals will only have one of each specialty on at a time. It's a matter of working hours for doctors. All specialists aren't on all of the time. So if the hospital says you're going to have Mr. Bloggs or Miss Nurk, then the hospital is clearly choosing the doctor for the patient, and the hospital, in my view, in that circumstance, assumes a non-delegable duty of care to that patient. If an anaesthetist is chosen by the hospital for a particular operating list, in my view, that will increase the chances that, in fact, almost certain, that that hospital will have assumed a non-delegable duty of care for that anaesthetic. Pathology and radiology services provided by an on-site monopoly provider is a particularly interesting scenario. Here is a page that I've shamelessly copied from the website of the Epworth Hospital in Richmond. You've got the web reference there. And Epworth runs its own Epworth Pathology. Now, it may be that because if it is a subsidiary, it may be straightforward that Epworth is, that is the hospital, has a non-delegable duty for those services. But if you're an inpatient at Epworth and you have a blood test taken or an X-ray taken, then the performance of those services, that is the interpretation of the blood film or the interpretation of the X-ray, will be undertaken effectively. It'll be by the radiologist or the pathologist, but the hospital will bear a non-delegable duty of care because that patient has no option but to use these doctors. That is, that won't apply to an outpatient referral, a patient who's seen their GP or their specialist nearby and has a range of options they could have gone to, but they choose to come to Epworth to have their blood test. In an outpatient setting, it's different. But an inpatient, inpatients are captive audiences. This is a monopoly provider. The hospital has chosen the doctor. Another example at Cabrini Health, again taken straight from their website, and this is the regarding the radiology services. So you can have all of these things done, again, for inpatients in Cabrini who are having their radiology. In my view, the hospital is assuming a non-delegable duty of care for those radiology services. So what can a hospital do, a private hospital, if it doesn't want to bear that non-delegable duty? Well, there's not a lot. The first thing you could do is provide two patients attending the emergency department who are going to need to be admitted. You could provide to them several names. You can say, here's a small risk board. Today for you, madame, we have Dr. Boggs, Ms. Graham, Ms. Smith, and you can give a list. That has practical difficulties because all of those specialists probably don't want to be on call all of the time. So it's a management problem for the hospitals. The next two options I don't think are practical solutions, that is, operating an emergency department, which is effectively becomes an emergency department for pre-existing patients of doctors with admitting rights. That's just not going to be a practical solution, as is accepting admissions via referral from a doctor with admitting rights. It is possible that a hospital could contract with its visiting specialists such that the visiting specialists retain liability for their negligent conduct. And I'm sure that is what usually happens. The difficulty for the hospital is that in law it's a non-delegable duty if the hospital is undertaking to provide those medical services. So while there may be a private arrangement that the doctor will indemnify the hospital for his or her conduct, a plaintiff is able to name both the doctor and the hospital, and at law they will be the hospital will be vicariously liable for the conduct of the doctor. That is, enforcing that contract would be very difficult. The private contract between the hospital and the doctor, which says the doctor will bear all of the liability for his or her own conduct, even if the hospital is named as a defendant, is not going to be enforceable in law because the doctor can't go along to the court and say, the hospital can't go along to the court and say, we've got this private agreement, because the nature of the non-delegable duty is you can't delegate out of it, you can't contract out of it. However, having said that, just going back to that, I can't imagine as a matter of practice that any doctor would ever join a hospital at which he or she is working, because, first of all, they will feel responsible for the conduct and won't blame the hospital for it, assuming it's something the hospital had nothing to do with. And also, as a matter of an ongoing working relationship, no doctor is going to want to join a hospital as being liable for their conduct. So these principles apply equally to public and private hospitals. Here's a photograph of the entrance to Monash Medical Centre, Clayton. And here is, quote directly lifted from the website at Monash Medical Centre about a decade ago. Many public hospitals, and Monash Medical Centre in particular, developed a campaign of encouraging patients who have private health insurance but who look like they're about to be admitted as a public patient to be admitted as private patients, that is, use their private health insurance. That's because the bed costs will be borne by the private insurer and not state, and a lot of the associated costs can be given over to the insurer. There was an agreement that the patients wouldn't be out of pocket. And here's what the website says. It says, as Victoria's largest teaching hospital, we're able to treat chronic and complex illnesses. Being a private patient in a public hospital, you can use your specialist of choice. If they are unavailable, you can choose to be treated by a hospital specialist on call at that time where you will be admitted under the care of that doctor. What this is saying is that if you came along already having had a private treating specialist, then you can be admitted under them. And then the questions of who undertook to provide medical care to the patient become a little more blurred. However, if the patient's in the emergency department at Monash and is persuaded and chooses to apply their private health insurance, the likely thing, this goes to that, is that the hospital's saying, Dr. Nurk is on today, you'll be admitted under Dr. Nurk's care. The hospital in that setting is assuming, in my view, the undertaking to provide medical care to the doctor and the hospital more liable. A hospital can delegate its care where it doesn't undertake to provide the medical care to a competent doctor. So most private hospitals where patients come along with their doctor in their back pocket already, they come along and say, I'm having my tonsils out, I'm a patient of Dr. Bloggs. The hospital's not providing medical care, so it's straightforward. There is one further consideration, and that is the hospital has to ensure that the doctor is competent, and that means credentialing. I can't tell you how long it took me to work out the difference between credentialing and accreditation. It seems in the parlance of this process, credentialing is about credentialing an individual as being competent. Accreditation applies to institutions, particularly hospitals. So, hospitals have to undertake credentialing. And it used to be that effectively, if you're a registered medical practitioner, it's a pretty straightforward matter to get visiting rights at a private hospital, and that's not so anymore. Now, the hospital is likely to be held to have an obligation to look at the doctor's training, qualifications, references, any conditions imposed on their licence, any matters or adverse events that have been reported against them, and the doctor's likely to have, as I mentioned earlier, an ongoing obligation of discovery, if you like, of disclosure to the hospital that any adverse events. So, if a plaintiff could show that the credentialing process of the hospital was inadequate in some way, or that this hospital had some, this doctor had some dark secret in his past, or something that was relatively easily discoverable by the hospital, then the hospital will become liable if it hasn't satisfied itself that this is a competent doctor. Recently, the National Health and Hospitals Network Act has been enacted, and there is now a new Australian Commission on Safety and Quality in Healthcare. However, they're obviously still arranging their desks at the Commission because the current standard is 7 years old, that is 2004, is the standard for credentialing and defining the scope of clinical practice, and that's easily available on the web. That is, what should hospitals be doing to undertake credentialing? So, I had a physics teacher in HSC some time ago who used to say to me, well, interesting, Kelling, but how is it relevant? And the answer is, what practical relevance is this? Well, for plaintiffs, it's relevant if the doctor disappears. If you cannot locate a doctor, if you can't find an insurer for the doctor, then the issues of is the hospital where the patient is treated become relevant. Also, when you get a doctor who has a firm view about her liability, the plaintiff may know that this doctor feels they did everything perfectly, and that may be a legitimate view, but the plaintiff feels differently, then it may be useful to add a hospital as a defendant if you have a basis for doing so, because then the hospital can help the doctor understand the hospital's and hopefully the plaintiff's view, if that's the case. What value is this for defendants? For defendants, it's important that private hospitals properly credential their doctors. And the key question is, did the hospital introduce the doctor to the plaintiff? There's also a place for considering the arrangements with pathology and radiology practices, particularly that are monopoly service providers to inpatients at hospitals. So in conclusion, overall, it's a matter of looking at the nature of the relationship between the doctor and the hospital. Is this going to be interpreted by the court to be an employment relationship, in which case the hospital will have private or public of a privately treated doctor becomes liable, and has the hospital introduced the patient to to the doctor, in which case the hospital will have been held to be have taken on providing medical services to that patient. Does anybody have any questions? Yeah. Mr. Schaefer.
Yeah, Sharon, how relevant to this debate is the fact that the doctor is a part owner of the hospital?
Mr. Schaefer's question is, how relevant to this discussion is the fact that a doctor may be a part owner to the hospital? That's a fascinating question, and one that I'm sure arises more than we might think. It would be relevant in the sense that if the doctor is a part owner, then obviously they become the hospital, if you like. And so it doesn't really confuse the matters. It just makes there's two lines of liability for the doctor, liable for his or her own conduct. In prima facie, doctors are always responsible for their own conduct regarding patients, no matter what the relationship with a hospital or a patient. If they treat, they're liable, except if they're a good faith Samaritan. Then the doctor becomes liable as an owner, that is, on behalf of the hospital as well, not for the conduct, but because they are the hospital. So there's two routes there, if you like, and a plaintiff would be well advised to sue them both. Yes. Any other questions? Going once. One at the back.
Could you provide some further clarification about visiting medical offices? I mean, a lot of the regional hospitals now are using fee-for-service providers because they don't have the specialists there.
Yes. The question is about visiting medical offices. Effectively, most of the discussion today has been about visiting medical offices, that is, whether it's a large city hospital or a smaller rural hospital. If the arrangement is private, and when I say private, I mean that the patient, as you say, pays a fee for service, and it may be that that fee for service is the Medicare rebate. Many large metropolitan hospitals have gone down the route of privatising, for example, their outpatient clinic, and it's exactly the same scenario that you're mentioning. That is, the doctor comes into the hospital, there's an arrangement between the doctor and the hospital that the doctor attends for certain sessions. And then when the patient arrives, they hand over their Medicare card, it's swiped, they sign, it's bulk billed, so the patient's not out of pocket. In my view, that means that the hospital is providing medical services, whether it's a VMO or not. That is, this is a doctor where the hospital is introducing the patient to the doctor. This is not a doctor who's come along to the hospital, given a list to the hospital and said, these are my patients that I've seen in my rooms or I've had referred to me by a GP, if they're a specialist, and I'm going to see them in your hospital. That's, if that were the case, then it would be purely that the doctor is introducing the patient to the hospital. But where you've got privatised outpatient clinics or rural settings where it's a fee for service, in my view, the hospital is likely a significant risk to be found to be undertaking to provide those medical services, notwithstanding whatever the contractual arrangements might be. Any other questions? Yes? Michael, Mr. Regos.
Hi, Michael. Thank you for your thoughts on all of that, Sharon. And going to your last issue about the relevance of all of this, in your research in preparing the paper, have you come across one case in which a doctor in a private hospital has been, that the hospital's been found liable for that doctor's conduct, and I'm excluding someone who might have been treated in an emergency department?
The answer is no. As you know, there are a lot of cases where a patient's been treated in an emergency department, and my experience is that the hospitals in that circumstance will indemnify the doctor because of the nature of the arrangements. The short answer is no, I haven't. But what I'm suggesting is that there is a basis for, in particular circumstances that have been outlined, there is a basis for the hospital being held to be liable. And I think that it's not going to come from the doctors. The doctors aren't going to say, oh, I've been sued, I'm wondering if I can get the hospital in on this. That's just not going to happen. But certainly from the plaintiff point of view, where you can't find a privately treating doctor, or where you've got a recalcitrant doctor or a doctor, who's got a view about his or her liability, then it's very useful for plaintiffs. It's important for defendants to be aware, because I think it's a real possibility. And perhaps giving this talk may change that.
Sharon, you're talking here about authorities, you're not talking about, you could possibly talk about several cases.
Oh, of course not. No, of course not. No, I'm not suggesting at all.
The answer to Mr. Regos's question is
Mr. Schaefer is suggesting that there may have been scenarios or cases, in fact, issued cases where it may be that, in fact, this scenario has applied, that is, the private hospital or the public hospital has been sued as being responsible for the doctor's care, notwithstanding the visiting nature or subcontracting nature, the private relationship, and that may be so. I can't speak to that.
Sharon, I've certainly had a case that was like that some years ago, Michael. I've just going to say that I've had a case which was difficult because there was an insurance issue with the emergency doctor, and the private hospital was sued too. In fact, I think there were about 10 defendants because it was an awful arrangement between private group of doctors owning the hospital. But it certainly settled with contribution from those parties.
So there we have first-hand evidence that, in fact, this situation has arisen and has been, it sounds like, pursued, and obviously can't comment on the outcome because that would be breaching of confidentiality. But it's certainly, in my view, given the changing nature of the relationship between particularly public hospitals, encouraging people to use their private insurance, and the increasing nature of people being treated privately, really brings this to the fore. Are there any other questions? Yes?
Sharon, I'm interested in your comment that if the hospital appoints an anaesthetist for a certain operating list,
yes,
then in your view that's a situation in which the hospital arguably owes a non-delegable duty of care.
Yes.
What about a situation in which the surgeon chooses the anaesthetist,
yes,
who will be on their list, and that anaesthetist has operating rights at the hospital and has been properly credentialed? Is it still a case in which you could say that the hospital has introduced the patient to the anaesthetist and therefore has a non-delegable duty of care, or does that put a different scenario?
I think it's a quite different scenario, Ms. Ridd, thank you, because the hospital is not responsible. It hasn't introduced the patient to the anaesthetist. The anaesthetist has come via the surgeon, assuming that the surgeon, sophistication on that is, how did the patient get to the surgeon? If the patient got to the surgeon through the emergency department or other direct referral arrangement via the hospital, then in my view, it becomes more likely that the anaesthetist will, the hospital will owe a non-delegable duty of care for the conduct of the anaesthetist, as it will for the surgeon. Can't say, you know, guaranteed, but in my view, the nature of the arrangement is such that the hospital, because it's provided the surgeon comes in her handbag with her own anaesthetist, that is, the surgeon, the hospital is saying, here's the anaesthetist you're going to use. So it makes it more likely that the hospital will owe a non-delegable duty of care. Any other questions?
With the employment relationship, with the different sort of indicia in the medical situation, which do you see as being sort of the stronger indicia, the more standout one?
Which is determinative?
Yeah.
I don't know the answer to that because this has never been tried. That is, that we don't have an authority where a judge has said, it's really important that you work full-time at this hospital, or it's most important that you have to work in the operating sessions that the hospital set. So in the Stevens and the Vabu sense, it's always a totality, so you sort of step back and get a bird's-eye view of the gestalt. It's unlikely that any one factor is going to be determinative, but more death by a thousand cuts, if you like. That is, how many factors are pushing towards an employment relationship, how many are pushing away from it. So each obviously will turn on its facts, and I don't think there is one determinative. It's unlikely there'd be one determinative feature. I'm mindful of the time, and that we all need to go to work. So thank you for your attendance this morning.
Thank you very much, Sharon, for your very stimulating, interesting area and quite dynamic. Just one thought occurred to me. Some of the indicia that Sharon gave, for example, doctors who are credentialed may be told they have to report any incident. It would seem to me to be amazing if the credentialing didn't require them to report any incident, to report any complaints they'd made. And I know that hospitals can require doctors to use certain equipment because they may, it may cost the hospital money if the equipment's too expensive. So there, as she said, you have to look at all the factors, not just one. Thank you again, Sharon, and thank you all for attending. Our website tells you when the next Greens breakfast is. They're all good. Come along to them, and thank you for attending.